Hello there and welcome to IASB Update, your monthly summary of the proceedings of the IASB meeting, which this month took place between the 22nd and the 24th of October at our offices in London. My name's Chris Welsh, I'm the Communications Manager here at the IFRS Foundation, and I'm joined here today by Alan Teixeira, Senior Technical Director at the IASB, and Stephen Cooper, who is a member of the IASB. Without further ado, gentlemen, thanks for joining us again today. We're going to go through some of the finer details of the board's discussions during the meeting. To start off with, Alan, some discussions on the disclosure initiative.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. There are two parts that we discussed this time. The first was a set of amendments that we have proposed to one of our core standards, IS1, which essentially is the standard that gives you the form and structure of the financial statements and then information about the notes. And we've had put out for comments some ways to, unshackle, we often call it, some of the constraints that people say that they perceive that's stopping them actually communicating effectively in financial statements. The comments had come back, we analysed them, or did an overview last month, and this month we had a look at two other of the more specific issues. The only reason we looked at the two rather than all the six or seven that we exposed is that we had very strong positive feedback on just about everything we were proposing. The only two that really we had a close look at was the order of the notes. There's some mixed views amongst our users that some people would like to have a more the order of the notes to reflect the same order that items are reflected in the primary statement, such as the same as the balance sheet order, for example. And others would like a little bit more flexibility so people can put the most important ones first. We just had a look at some of the wording that we have in there, and going ahead with, we will allow more flexibility, but we're not going to promote any particular way of ordering them. The emphasis is that it has to be a systematic way, and people have to think about what they're trying to achieve in terms of communication, and we're giving examples like order of importance or putting together similar types of items or following the structure of the primary statements. The other was just the importance of, some people call these non-IFRS numbers, basically subtotals. And so if somebody puts a subtotal like operating profit or a gross margin on the statement of comprehensive income, it must be very clear on the statement itself how they got from one number to another, so that's what we're clarifying as well. So really, apart from those two items, we went went through all the due process papers, and we're starting the balloting process. And the objective is to have that out in December this year, so it will be this side of Christmas that we finalise those. The second thread was more of our general, what we call Principles of Disclosure project, which is the broader project to replace three of our standards that relate to presentation, income statement, the statement of financial position, cash flows, and accounting policies. And we had a look at three papers this time. One is the purpose of the notes and the purpose of the statement of comprehensive income and statement of financial position, and to see if we could actually identify a clear purpose for each one. I won't go into much detail again, and I'm sure people can have a look at the papers on our website, because all the staff papers are there. But we ask the question, if you've got, most people then present a statement of income, what purpose does it serve? And in most cases, we think it gives you a bit of a summary history of where they've generated their accounting revenues and expenses from. So we discussed that. No decisions particularly, but it will be feed its way into the discussion paper. We discussed whether we should develop communication principles. It was one of those tricky discussions, because I don't think anybody disagrees that good communication principles are helpful, but it's whether, as a standard setter, we should do that or leave that to others to provide. So it's possible that we'll put some educational material together, it's non-authoritative material, and just indicate some good practice communication aspects as they relate to financial statements. And the last was a discussion on cash flows and cash flow statements and how we might structure those. This is one where we're working in partnership with the UK Financial Reporting Council. One of their staff has been doing the work with us, and we had a look at a draft chapter essentially about structure and organisation of the cash flow statement. So all those three are feeding into a discussion paper that is scheduled for release next year.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. Appreciate that. Stephen, moving on. Leases.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. The in the leases project, we talked about the definition of a lease. This is something the board has spent quite a lot of time on before, and indeed, we largely reconfirmed prior decisions in this session, albeit we left open one particular issue after having a discussion. The staff are going to come back. Let me recap on the definition of a lease. The definition we've decided on is that it's a contract that conveys the right to use an asset, which is the underlying asset, for a period of time in exchange for consideration. And in determining whether a contract contains a lease, what you've got to do is to identify whether the use of an identified asset is either explicitly or implicitly specified. For example, a contract would not involve the use of an identified asset if a supplier has a substantive right to substitute a different asset to fulfill the contract. So it's got to be an identified asset. And then secondly, the customer, so the lessee, has to control the use of the identified asset. And that kind of is crucial, because if you don't control the use and somebody else is using it to provide you with some benefit, then it's essentially a service. So your supplier is using the asset to provide you with a service, then it's not a lease. If you're using the asset for your own benefit and the asset is identified, then it's not a service, but you have a right of use. And we have more words other than the ones which I've just given you that elaborate on that. It's a very clear principle, and obviously we have to explain it very carefully so that it can be applied in a consistent way. There was, however, a question of what happens if, whilst it might be an identified asset, the ability to use that asset is dependent upon specialized services. So maybe the asset requires a specially trained operator to operate that asset. What if that operator is supplied by the lessor? So does that mean that you control the asset? Well, if the lessor is supplying the skilled operator and you need that operator to operate the asset, do you really have control? And we talked about a situation where there's specialized resources readily available when it's supplied only by the lessor, whether the lessor supplies this separately on a standalone basis. So we had a long discussion surrounding this type of situation to discuss whether we felt there was any need to modify the definition of a lease to take into account the complexities of these types of contracts. We didn't make any decisions. The board members individually provided their own particular input, and there were differing views. The staff are going to go away, consider the input that was received from the individual board members, and then they'll come back with a recommendation on what we should do in these situations where the asset is operated or comes along with other specialized services. So that was leasing.
Great, thank you. Okay, Alan, moving on to our research agenda. We've got two projects to discuss today, one foreign currency and the other liabilities equity. I guess you'll take us through these.
Yep, thanks. So, foreign currency translation was the first. Quite a bulky set of papers for that one, and that reflected a lot of work that had been done for us by the Korean Accounting Standards Board. So some of their research papers we tabled as part of this. Essentially, there were two things here. The first is the Koreans had asked us to look at a particular situation that we think is a relatively rare combination of circumstances when you have a thinly traded currency and there's financial crisis, as we had with the global financial crisis, and that causes a particular period of high volatility for the currency. And when you get circumstances like that, you can get quite large gains and losses on long-term monetary items. And in the particular, a couple of sectors like the long-term shipping building industry, where they're denominated in a foreign currency, you can get quite strong fluctuations. And they asked us to have a look to see whether we should or could change the way that those are translated. We had a look at the analysis, and the ISB decided not to take that proposal any further, so there won't be any proposal to change that. But the Koreans also did a significant amount of work on longer-term issues, and they did analysis of what they perceived to be some problems with IAS 21, which is our standard on foreign currency translation. and asked us to consider looking at a more fundamental project to review or and replace that standard. We had a good discussion about that. At the moment, we, in the light of their analysis and our staff analysis of the individual issues, the fact that I think we've only had five interpretation requests in the last 12 years or so on that particular standard, and the feedback from the last agenda consultation. What we decided to do is we're going to retain it on our research program, but we're going to move it. At the moment, it's in that one of our shorter term projects that we've been working on. We're going to move that to the longer term program. We don't plan to do much work on that ourselves, but we are going back to the Career Accounting Standards Board and inviting them if they want to do further analysis or others want to. We'll have a look at that perhaps towards later towards 2015, towards the end. And then as part of the agenda consultation, then people will have a lot of information that will help feedback and see whether in fact we should actually reconsider and go back to a broader project. So it remains there, and we're grateful for the work the Career Accounting Standards Board did, but it's just been moved lower on our priorities so we can get some other things done.
Sure.
The other was, I hate this title, saying it, I always stumble over the words, but it's financial instruments with characteristics of equity. So that liabilities equity definition.
It rolls off the tongue there.
It does, yeah. And so just brief history is we've had many issues that have gone to Interpretations Committee. The Interpretations Committee struggled, they've come back to the board. We don't think we can solve some things like what we call puts on minority and non-controlling interests without actually re-looking at the standard. So we looked at it as part of the Conceptual Framework Project. The Framework Project's not going to do anything significant in terms of the split between liabilities and equity. Most of the definitional changes in liabilities for liabilities in our Conceptual Framework Project relate to the less certain ones like lawsuits and things like that. So, and again, it's very hard on a podcast we visualise, but it's sort of like, what's the limit or outer limit of a liability? Then the second question is, you agree that somebody's got a claim against an entity. Where do you draw the line and say, well, the claim is actually a liability or the claim is equity? And this other project on liabilities equity is now, it's moved away from conceptual framework and it's being done in the research program. We're going to go ahead and staff are putting a plan together for a discussion paper, probably in 2015. The idea is to have a look to see how we might characterise the liability equity split, whether some additional disclosures might be appropriate. For characteristics of instruments, whether they're liabilities or equity. In other words, there are some features that make it interesting because they're going to be close to that sort of boundary. The difficult thing is that people might perceive that because we're going to look at liability equity definition in a separate project, having just put out an ED on, we will have by then on conceptual framework, we're going to keep changing it. And our perception is no. The work in the framework is about this general, what claims are there against an entity. So that's sort of the outer limits. Then drawing the line between the two, we don't think we're going to upset any of those, that original work in the framework. So this will build on the framework. We've always said it's a living document, and we'll have a look at see what feedback we get on that project.
Okay, thanks very much. Moving on, Stephen, insurance contracts.
Yeah, just one topic that we discussed in insurance, which is transition. So the approach in the ED, the 2013 ED, was that we would apply the standard retrospectively. This, of course, is our normal approach under IAS 8 and what we would normally regard as giving the best information in terms of restating comparatives, presenting the financial statements as though the new accounting policy had always been in place. And then we had some simplifications that was available within that ED to deal with situations where that would be difficult. We've essentially reconfirmed that, so the retrospective application with the simplifications. However, we have made one modification, and that's to the risk adjustment at the date of initial recognition of the contract. What we said within the ED is that we can measure the risk adjustment at the date of transition, and then we would assume that that was the risk adjustment at the date of initial recognition for the purpose of calculating the CSM. We felt that we wouldn't we wouldn't be able to ask people to go back and recalculate that initial risk adjustment because of the problems of hindsight and the like. The problem with the modification, the problem with that simplification that we made is that it would result in the automatic overstatement of CSM at the time of initial recognition and then the overstatement of CSM at the at the date of transition. Now, we knew that, but we felt that the greater operationality of making that modification was worth the margin of error, if you like. However, many people pointed this out within the feedback, and we have decided to make an adjustment, and that is that you use the risk adjustment at the transition and then work backwards from that to make an assumption about release from risk to get to what the risk adjustment was at the date of initial recognition. Sounds very complicated. It's probably expressed rather better than I've just done within the update. But the upshot is that we will get to a more representative transition CSM and not this overstated CSM, which was the problem with the ED. So that really is the key change. Other people, however, did raise the problem of, well, going back and recalculating this CSM does require on having information available, so this retrospective application. For example, if you don't know what your contract acquisition costs were 20 years ago when the contract was initially recognized, for example, you can't actually work out that original CSM. So because of that, we've decided to give another sort of relief, if you like, which is that if applying retrospective and the simplifications is impracticable, then an entity should apply a fair value approach to determine CSM at the date of the transition. And what that is saying, taking the difference between the fair value of the insurance contract liability and the present value of the fulfillment contract cash flows, including the risk adjustment at the date of transition, and then the difference is the CSM at the date of transition. Now, it's not retrospective application because it doesn't reflect the actual profitability of the contract when it was first issued. That would be full retrospective, but it's a practical way of getting to a transition CSM that has meaning and has relevance, even though it's not full retrospective application. You know, this standard is going to require significant changes for companies writing insurance contracts. It's complex. Insurance contracts themselves are complex. And rebooting the system to get to a point where we can move forward in a more comparable, consistent, more relevant fashion has to involve an element of compromise. We can't necessarily do full retrospective because of the limitations on the information that's available for what is in many cases very long-term contracts. So we've made these modifications in the light of the feedback we received on the 2013 ED. We still think that it will provide a relevant starting point at transition to provide relevant measures going forwards, but at the same time it takes into account the practicalities and the cost of doing so. There's one other thing I should mention, and that is the OCI at transition. A transition OCI, if the option to apply the OCI approach is taken, has to be determined, and that is done with reference to interest rates at the date of the initial recognition of the contract. We have made no change to what was in the ED in that area. There were some that wanted us to make a change. They felt that when the contracts were written in a very different environment and forcing them to go back and calculate what the transition OCI would be wouldn't be fair. We've looked at that issue and we've decided that it is appropriate that we have a transition accumulated OCI amount to reflect the difference between interest rates at the time the contract was written and interest rates at the transition date. So there's no change in that regard compared with the 2013 ED.
Thank you very much. So last but not least, certainly not least actually, the conceptual framework. It's going to be a joint effort, I believe. Alan, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll start off. Measurement is clearly an important component of the conceptual framework. The board had a look at another paper on measurement and the measurement basis. Again, easier to look at the papers on the website, so I won't go into much detail. I think it's important to emphasise it's not going to be prescriptive in terms of specifying how the board should select a measurement attribute, but it will provide a much better basis for the board to be consistent when they do specify the attributes. So it will describe the measurement basis that available, their characteristics, and some principles for making sure that we select more appropriate ones or the most appropriate ones for particular items.
So the next bit in conceptual framework is the potential for there being inconsistencies between the revised framework and existing standards. Now, inconsistencies between the framework and standards is not unheard of at the moment. The board should make its best endeavours to make standards consistent with the framework, but the board can depart, and we're going to maintain that principle going forwards that departures under rare circumstances are permitted. However, if we change the framework, we may well increase the number of inconsistencies between existing standards and that framework. Not least, for example, if we were to change the definition of a liability, which is the proposal we have within the revised framework. So what do we do under those circumstances then? Well, firstly, we're going to explain that changing the framework doesn't automatically override an existing standard. The standards remain in place until the time comes for us to make changes to those standards or decide not to change the standards. So the standards remain in force. What we are going to do, though, is to describe the potential inconsistencies between the existing standards and the revised conceptual framework within the basis of the conclusions accompanying the exposure draft, because I think it's important that our constituents are aware of what the implications of changing the framework might be for existing standards were we to decide to make a change, and to provide that clarity and the basis for them to respond to the ED for the framework, we're going to provide this list of an explanation of what those potential inconsistencies might be. But it's important to emphasise that any changes to existing standards would have to go through the normal due process. And by itself, issuing the framework does not change our existing standards and does not change accounting derived from those standards.
Yeah, we had a look at another couple of issues about as a consequence of the framework. One, I think it's not a relatively innocuous change, is that we're going to propose some changes to references to the framework. At the moment, the existing standards refer to the older framework, so we will we'll propose changing the references to update that. But just to Steve's point as well, you know, two of the issues they looked at were to do with IS1 and IS8, which these are standards that are part of the disclosure initiative as well. Something as simple as the term reliability. For those who follow the framework, we replaced the term reliable or reliability with faithful representation when the framework was altered a few years ago. And yet we still have the term reliability used often throughout our standards. And we're not proposing at this stage when we go out to automatically change all those references from reliable to faithfully representative. We're going to wait until the framework's finalised, and then in the same way as Steve's described, when appropriate, we might have a look and change those references. We could either do that as a package or when each standard comes up for review, post-implementation review or something like that. So fairly, considered approach to making sure that we do this framework first, standards when appropriate. And that pretty much completes, I think, the deliberations. As I know, we're going to look at potential sweep issues. So these are issues that you identified during drafting, but yeah. Staff at the moment have been drafting the exposure draft, and we start our formal balloting or voting process internally. We'll start shortly, and we're looking at the first quarter next year for the exposure draft.
Good stuff. Great progress, and pretty rapidly done considering the amount of work there. So well done to the team on that. So thank you very much. I would encourage listeners who want to delve deeper into these topics to take a look at firstly the board papers, which are all online. If you just click through in the calendar onto the ISB's meeting, you'll see all of the papers discussed during the meeting this month. available online. There's also ISB Update, which is a slightly more comprehensive written summary of today's podcast. So if there's anything you're interested in seeing in a bit more detail, in that update you'll find some references to a comprehensive update of the IFRS for SMEs, for instance, which is one of the topics covered during the meeting that we didn't have a chance to discuss today. Coming up this week, I think we've got the Global Preparers Forum, which is an annual event, I believe.
No, it's three or four times a year.
Three
or
four times,
it's quite a frequent one.
My mistake, yeah. A regular event held here in London. Last week, I believe we also had the IFRS Taxonomy Consultative Group. So anyone interested in that particular area of accounting can also go on our website and find details of that. Next meeting will be on the 13th to the 21st of November, so expect another update from us shortly after then. Once again, thanks for listening. Thank you, Alan and Steve.